interruptions. If you are planning on getting a book signed tonight, you will find most of Matthew's books downstairs. We do ask that you purchase your book before getting it signed, and the other two authors, Miles Corwin and Michael Connelly, will be signing their books as well. They will not be signing here at the table, but you're free to come up to them and ask if you can get your book signed. Also, I will be calling people by the last three digits of their tickets. If you have not received a signed line ticket, don't worry, I will be calling you at the end. And with that said, let's get started. Thank you all for joining us for the presentation of Matthew McGough's The Lazarus Files. Matthew's nonfiction writing has been published in The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The LA Times. His acclaimed memoir, Bat Boy, Coming of Age with the Yankees, was the basis of the CBS series Clubhouse. He is a former legal consulting writer for NBC's Law and Order. Joining us tonight is Michael Connelly and Miles Corwin. Michael is the best-selling author of 32 novels, including Dark Sacred Night, Two Kinds of Truth, The Black Box, and more. His debut novel, The Black Echo, won the prestigious Edgar Award for Best First Novel. Meanwhile, Miles Corwin is a former LA Times reporter and author of three nonfiction titles, including The Killing Season, And Still We Rise, and Homicide Special, as well as two novels. And with that said, please join me in welcoming Matthew McGough, Michael Connelly, and Miles Corwin.
This is about a true crime that was, I almost use the word celebrated. It's just a very famous case, so many of you probably know some of the basics about it, but it was probably best for to start off with the guy who spent 10 years researching it and writing about it to tell us what it's about in less than 20 words.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. The book is primarily about the 1986 murder of a woman named Sherry Rasmussen, who was killed in Van Nuys, a section of the valley. At the time, the police initially believed that she was the victim of a botched burglary. She interrupted a burglary and was beaten and shot to death. And that was the focus of the police investigation back then. Leaving a lot out in the story, but among the evidence that was collected in 1986 was a swab of a bite mark she was bitten during this very intense physical struggle. And that piece of evidence stayed in a freezer in the basement of the coroner's office for upwards of pretty much the next 20 years. Around 2004-2005, DNA analysis was done on that bite mark swab. And the results indicated that the individual who bit Sherry was in fact a woman, not a man, which is what all of the investigations at that point had been focused on. So again, jumping ahead a couple of years, in 2008-2009, a team of detectives in the Van Nuys Division, the homicide unit, I know at least one or two of them are here this evening, they reopened this case, and mindful of this female DNA result, focused on potential female suspects, spoke to Sherry Rasmussen's widow, John Rudden, and Sherry's family, and quickly identified a suspect who, to their shock, was an active duty LAPD detective named Stephanie Lazarus, who was the ex-girlfriend of John Rudden. The victim's husband. So these four guys in Van Nuys, there's not too many heroes in this story, but there's certainly among them, reopened the case, eventually obtained, or set in motion, a team that obtained Stephanie's DNA surreptitiously, following her around, and she discarded the cup, and then that DNA was compared to the bite mark swab. It was a match and led to her arrest.
Can I get your question?
I don't cut anybody off.
That's the short version of the answer.
To me, it was so fascinating, you know, just that there was missing evidence. There was missing evidence, you know, and I was just wondering if you could talk about that and how that plays a part in your investigation and how you and some of the stumbling blocks and how you overcame them.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues in the history of this case and opportunities. Again, hindsight is 20/20. Detective work, like any other work, it's easy to look back and say how did this happen or why did they see it for what it was at the time. Some of those questions are open questions, but yeah, there were issues through the years where evidence in the case went missing. And how that happened, why it happened, I get into in the book. Some of the questions are unanswerable, but it happened.
Did you draw any connection between the fact that the suspect in the case, the killer in the case, was actually working in the division where the evidence was missing?
As Mile alludes, Stephanie did spend, you know, she was a... She joined the LAPD around 1983, 1984. The murder occurred in 86, so she had about 2 or 3 years on the job at that point. She was working as a patrol officer in the Devonshire Division, also in the Valley. After the murder, she didn't go anywhere. She stayed in the department, rose through the ranks, was promoted to detective in 94, I believe. And then over the next several years, worked assignments, including internal affairs. Was assigned to the Van Nuys unit twice in the 1990s, including with the homicide unit for a short period of time. So she unquestionably had access to the murder book and information on this unsolved murder. We now know that she committed.
You think it's possible she could have removed some of the evidence?
It's entirely possible. Yeah.
Plausible?
Possible and plausible. It's a fine line between possible and plausible, but yeah, it can go as far as possible.
I just want to make a comment that will lead to a question. You know, I write novels about, I mean, for the most part, about Harry Bosch, who's, and the model of the... thank you. The model of Bosch book is books and the TV show is, you know, he has to solve a murder, but sometimes he can't get the department out of his way. The department becomes the obstacle, and I build drama with that, and it's fiction. And that's exactly, I read this book, and it's like, this is a Harry Bosch story, but it's real, it really happened. And in many ways, the biggest obstacles to solve this case were inside the LAPD, and that's why I found the book fascinating. And I see the guy over here with the clover, the Irish hat. I see many people that I've seen here before when I do signings. And so my comment is, if you like what Harry Bosch does, there's some Harry Bosches in this book, a couple of detectives, more than a couple, and a forensic person and so forth. And we'll talk about the heroes in a while. But if you like what I do, you're going to like this book, because this is the true Harry Bosch type of stuff. And that leads me to the question is that when Stephanie Lazarus was arrested for this murder, you were writing on a TV show called Law and Order. So how does a TV writer for Law and Order end up spending, I guess, the next 10 years, 9 years, 8 years of your life on this book?
Stephanie was arrested June 2009. So that really was when my life sort of took a turn in a different direction. And the reason for that was that I actually had met Stephanie about a year before she was arrested, coincidentally. Her last position when she was arrested, she was an art theft detective for the LAPD, which is sort of an unusual position. I was writing for Law & Order.
She was a famous art theft detective. She was on the news all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, she did interviews, including with reporters like me when they asked. But yeah, she was not shy about giving public lectures and things like that in that post. But yeah, I was working on Law & Order, but I've always, for me being a writer, I've always dreamed of writing books. So I I had written one book, and I had decided, even while I was, my day job was writing scripts for Law and Order, I was thinking, what's the next book I want to write? And I wanted to write nonfiction journalism. So I got interested in the theft of a painting in Norway, The Scream, and thought I would write a book about that. And so in 2008, read that the LAPD had an art theft detail and decided that I would contact them and request an interview. So I sat down with Stephanie and her partner at the time for more than an hour, talked with them about their work, and then sort of forgot about it for a while. And then it was a year later, it was literally the first day of what turned out to be the last season of Law and Order. The one that I was writing on was the main one, the mothership, they call it, with Jack McCoy and those characters. And so it was all these sort of grizzled TV writers, Law and Order veterans, where everyone knows it's ripped from the headlines. So the process of coming up with ideas for episodes, it's everybody in a room throwing ideas out, what about this story? Or so one of these guys, and I was like the most junior person on the team, one of them said, well, I heard on the radio today that a LAPD detective got arrested for doing a murder. And one of the other writers is, oh, you know, we did that season 13. well, it was a female cop and it was a love triangle. Yeah, we did that too, season eight. And then he said she worked in art theft or something. And I was like, excuse me. Well, I just couldn't believe it. And then I was trying to remember she had a distinctive name. Couldn't place it right away. And then it came to me and I was like, was her name Lazarus? And he's like, yeah, that's it. And I was like, oh my God. And then they were like, your friend got arrested for murder? And like, your friend, but she was a police detective.
So did you throw down a script and walk out of the room and never be seen again?
Well, you know, the coin of the realm at that point, again, it would have been very easy for me to turn it into an episode of Law and Order, and it may have been good for my TV writing career at that time, but I really, my initial impulse was the opposite. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to turn it into fiction until I knew what the truth was. So I was just intensely curious to know, first of all, that day, was it true? Could it possibly be true that this woman who I sat down with went into police headquarters and interviewed, seemed perfectly cordial when I sat across from her, that she could have kept a secret like this all those years? And then beyond that, I wanted to know everything. Like, I wanted to know, why was this case solved now, and how does this, I knew how DNA, it's depicted on television and crime dramas, but I didn't want to know the TV version where you snap your fingers and they have the results when you come back from the commercial break or something. Like, I wanted to know the reality of it. So the first thing I did is I started going down to court. So it was pretty big news when Stephanie was arrested. It's not a common situation for a longtime detective to be arrested for a cold case murder, let alone a love triangle where she bit the victim. And then that DNA is what, you know, catches up with her. So it started by going down to court. So I attended Stephanie's arraignment, and then following the arraignment, the parents of the victim, Sherry Rasmussen, gave a press conference where they made allegations of essentially that they're, you know, the LAPD should have acted sooner on the information that they were given by people, including Sherry's own parents. So that was the start of it. And just because we're at Vroman's tonight, I have to credit both of you guys and Vroman's, just a quick story. So I was going down to court, and it was apparent to me that it was a sensitive story within the department. So I was getting a lot of information about the case in court, but I had other questions about the cold case unit and things like that that I wanted to know. And but I didn't have a way in. And I knew if I went to the department like I had done with the art theft thing, they probably would have turned me away and said, we're not doing interviews on this. So I didn't know either of you guys at that point, but I picked up Miles' book, Homicide Special, which is an amazing book. And about halfway through that book, you introduce a character named Rick Jackson, a LAPD detective, and describe him as a rabid baseball fan, as am I. And I thought, if I highlighted it in your book, and I thought, if I can maybe just get to Rick Jackson, maybe there'll be a chance. And so I sought out Rick, ended up interviewing him, and when I did, that day, he said, "What are you doing tonight? Michael Connelly has a reading of Romans tonight. You should come to Romans." So the same day that I met Rick, because of your book, I came up here, this very spot, and met you for the first time. And you know, I feel very lucky, you know, just to be up here with.
So do we get royalties?
Just a personal question, because I see a writer and some actors from Bosch here. When you write a Law and Order script, do you actually write in that dun-dun thing? Okay, so back to the story. Did you, at any point, were you able to talk to Stephanie or give a message to her? You know, kind of like, remember that art story I was going to write about you? Now it's changed a little bit.
Yeah, I've written to her three times since she was arrested. First, while her trial was pending, didn't hear back. Again, after she was convicted, to let her know that I was had sold the book and was writing it, interested in her perspective. And then most recently, just a couple days ago, to let her know that the book is done and to ask if she's interested to read it. So I could get a letter any day.
When you first interviewed her, when she's an artist, did she strike you in any sort of way? Because it's not interesting, the book, the pictures of her, it's really, those eyes are just, these Charles Manson-like eyes. It's like she's kind of anti-psychotic. So I was wondering what your impression was when you first met her.
Yeah, I didn't get any secret killer vibe off of her, but I wasn't looking for it, you know, in all fairness. She was cordial. She was the junior partner of the two people who I interviewed, so she maybe spoke a little bit less than her partner. But I talked with them both for more than an hour, so it was a big shock when she was arrested, and it sort of just lit this fire to want to know that is really what sort of carried me through the whole process of researching the story, writing the book.
Did you know this book right away, you were going to do a book, or was you thinking maybe first I was going to do a magazine story and then maybe expand it, or did you have that feeling?
I didn't know. It was pretty confusing and surreal at first. Like, I remember I had business cards from Law & Order. Those were the only business cards I had, and I was going down to court, and I didn't want to hand them out to people because I thought it would be confusing about what I'm after and what I'm here for. The more I learned, the more I wanted to know. And it was, it's a 30-year story. So the book is 600 pages long. It's way longer than I ever anticipated it might be or that I would ever write. But the story spans 30 years and there's just a ton of stories. So,
the one thing I would say is that we're selling this the wrong way, because you say the DNA did her in, and everyone knows from TV DNA is the hammer. But this book is so fascinating in all the turns it took, and the mistakes. I was recently doing research for one of my own books, and I learned that the LAPD has pretty much the highest clearance rate in the country when it comes to murder investigations. And yet I read this book and so many things happen by chance, and so many things happen because it went from, I know there's some detectives here, so I apologize if I'm offending anybody, but it went from some 9-to-5ers to some people who are on a mission. And a mission to, you know, everybody counts or nobody counts, and we're gonna find out who did this and let the chips fall. So it went from zeros to heroes, back to zeros, back to heroes, and all that. And it's like, to say, yeah, DNA solved this case, that's not the story at all. That's like two pages of this very thick book. And I suppose, and maybe you can talk about it, is that what sustained you? This is, you know, I write one book a year. You took a long time on this book because it required it, and things were still happening, I'm sure. But it's a journey, man. And you know, I know what a journey it is to write a book, you know. and this was a long journey for you, what were the things that sustained you? Was it coming across someone like Detective Bub or Detective Nuttall, who just did it all? I'm not, I got his name wrong, but
it was a team of four detectives in Van Nuys who really turned the ship around for the Rasmussen family. Rob Bub, who I think is here this evening, Jim Nuttall, Mark Martinez, and Pete Barbo were the four guys. And like you said, with the DNA, you know, looking back, now that this is all said and done, it's easy to think that it was inevitable, that it was just a matter of time until justice caught up to Stephanie, and that if these guys didn't do it, somebody else would have by now. But I think it's clear when you look closely at the story, it may not have been on that track at all until these guys picked it up, and they're sort of a obscure, humble unit, only four guys. I sort of juxtapose there the resources they had and things like that with RHD, which is much higher profile, better resourced. It was just these four guys who took it upon themselves, and then when they realized the sensitivity of what they were doing, looking at a fellow cop for murder, made a pact among the four of them to follow the evidence wherever it led, and they did exactly that. But yeah, to your point, it's a tragic story. There's only a few heroes in the story. They're certainly among them. And when when my motivation flagged, which may have been inevitable over a 10-year period, that there were days where I just didn't know when I'd get to the finish line or whatever, it was always helpful to think at, but my journey was 10 years. For the Rasmussen family, it's 30 years. And it's still going on. And so, again, Sherry's father, Nils Rasmussen, he had information about this female police officer. He communicated it to detectives at the time. The Rasmussens did not give up. They did everything that they could think of to try to keep their daughter's case alive. And it wasn't enough. The case went cold. The family got tired and essentially gave up after a time. Fast forwarding, there was a DNA analyst at the LAPD crime lab. Her name is Jennifer Francis. She is the one who dug up this bite mark swab that was in the coroner's basement that was very, very difficult to find. You almost sort of wonder if there's some divine intervention at work at various points.
What made her go look for it?
She, how to summarize, she was assigned the case, so she did not pick it. She was a brand new DNA analyst. She started doing analysis of evidence at the crime scene, and the original evidence results indicate there were different kinds of blood at the crime scene, type A and type O. So she thought it was naturally, this is a victim and a suspect. All I have to do is type this these blood samples. I'll get the victim sample, the victim's profile, the suspect's profile, and I'll be done. When she tested all the evidence, though, it all came back to the victim. Sherry turns out to have a rare blood type that sometimes shows up as A, sometimes is O. So when she started testing all the blood result, it didn't make sense to her. She kept getting the victim's blood. So she had access to the murder book, all the investigative reports at that time. And in reading through that, she read a reference to this bite mark swab. And it wasn't listed on any of the property reports where it might be, but she knew that people don't bite themselves, generally. And so she thought, if I can just find that swab, that's not gonna be the victim's DNA, that's gonna be the suspect's DNA. And so she called the coroner's office, basically a cold call. You know, normally it's the detective who's tracking down evidence. This is a civilian DNA analyst at the crime lab. She called the coroner's office and was told, we don't have anything on that case. She thought, maybe the first person I asked typed the number in wrong, I'm gonna call back again. She called back again and was told the same thing.
She said, I've put too much work into this case already to just walk away from it. She mentioned to a colleague, I think I'm going to call again. They're like, don't do that. You're going to get a bad reputation. It's a pain in the ass. Just let it go. You can't just keep calling and saying, do you have this thing? You've already called twice. But she called a third time, nonetheless, and got on the phone the gentleman, whose name is Lloyd Mahaney, who actually collected the bike mark swap. And she said to him, if you booked this in 1986, what would you have called it? And he said, bike mark swap. And she said, where do you keep your bike mark swabs? And he says, we don't throw out bike mark swabs. Those would be in the freezer. And he said he would look for it, and he came up with it. Jennifer did the testing, and again, that advanced the ball. It kept the case alive, whereas if she hadn't made that third call to the coroners, we wouldn't be sitting here today. And so I do see some continuity, sort of a passing of the torch between people who just won't let it be swept under the rug, won't let it fade away. They're all that's standing between it fading away, but they rise to the occasion. And these are people, again, none of them chose this situation. They were all thrust into it by virtue of circumstance, luck, divine providence, whatever you want to call it. The same is true, I think, for the Van Nuys detectives, who, again, they didn't know what they were getting into at the time that they got into it. And then, again, I have the utmost respect for what the work that all of those people do every day. I wouldn't put myself on that level with them, but certainly I, again, didn't know what I was getting myself into when I got into this, given how I did, and for sure just want to do as good a job with my part of it as Jennifer Francis did with her part of it, and the Van Nuys detectives did with their part of it, and honor, again, the journey that the Rasmussens have been on as a family that continues. So wanting to tell the truth on behalf of all the truth tellers in the story.
I think following the mind, so this is really one of the most fascinating cases in the homicide cases in the history of the LAPD. And I think it's so fascinating as a reader because you alternate between being infuriated and being inspired. And you know, some of the detectives initially, it's just infuriating, and then later it's inspiring. Maybe you could kind of talk about the ones who inspired you and the ones who infuriated you and why.
Yeah, well, the complexity of that was the challenge, but that sort of cuts both ways. Like it was hard and intimidating, a little bit scary to dive in there and try to be an arbiter as to what really happened. But you're right. I mean, it's a very serious case and it's a very serious failure. And if somebody's not going to look at what happened and what went wrong and what could have been done, you know, been done better, then it could happen again.
Maybe for those who haven't read the book or not super familiar with the case, you could maybe just outline.
Yeah. So again, and as you alluded, it was a process of reporting this thing. Like I began not knowing anything the day that she was arrested, and then I was going down to court, collecting court documents as they became public, transcripts, things like that, trying to interview people. It wasn't until after the trial happened that a lot of people were willing to be interviewed. You know, it was a very sensitive case all the way along. On paper, everything is about burglary suspects. Once I began interviewing people who were actually involved in the story, who lived through it, like the Rasmussens, different friends of Sherry Rasmussen, people who were there in 1986, it became apparent that there was a lot of information conveyed to the original detectives that did not end up in the records. And in the book, I tried to try to communicate why these policies exist and why it's important. You know, there's no statute of limitations on murder. Detectives retire. The detectives get transferred, cases get transferred. So the hedge against that inevitability that there's going to be other people who pick up this later on is later detectives are dependent on the original ones for their lens of the case. They read the reports that have been generated before, and detectives aren't really trained or hardwired to doubt the integrity of previous reports. So there's some confirmation bias that I think maybe comes into play later on, where the more cases this case, you know, the more hands it passes through, the harder it becomes maybe for some detectives to believe that something this big could possibly have been missed. So.
Well, I mean, we're old Times guys, and I know you've written for magazines, but you were a Law and Order guy. What I admire about the book, and by the way, we're not talking about spoilers here, this is definitely not a whodunit. This is how they finally got it, type of story, and it's just as fascinating as a whodunit. But very, really steeped in journalistic integrity in this book. There's not, you never get didactic about these moments of, and you know, you leave it up to the viewer to decide, was this malfeasance? Was it bad training? Was it laziness? Was it moral corruption? Was it looking away because it might be a cop? I mean, that's the far end of it. From, you know, it could be a cover up, it could just be they missed it and we need better, and the case needed a better detective. And you don't really come down, I don't know if you're, I guess I'm trying to say, you want to tell us what you really think? But the book does not make decisions about that. So it's really left to the reader to go through what Miles went through, outrage, and wow, I so much admire what this guy did, or this lady did. And I think that's one of the things that makes the book stand out as a piece of, you know, journalism.
Well, thank you. It means a lot coming from both of you guys. I would say,
I only said that, he didn't.
I didn't know what I was in for when I started getting into it. In the very early days, I thought the fact that I met Stephanie before she was arrested was one of the most interesting aspects of the story. As soon as I started learning the actual story, I was like, that's not interesting at all. And the way that things ended up, it's barely in the book. I think I acknowledge it in an author's note at the end, but it was clear. Again, it doesn't get more serious than murder and the accusations the Rasmussens were making, that detectives had looked the other way intentionally because Stephanie was a police officer, is also extremely serious. And it seemed to me the most, again, this murder happened in 1986. I was 11 years old at the time and living in New York. So it's hard, I can't be the arbitrator to say this is exactly what happened in 1986 in Los Angeles. I felt like the best that I could do and the most responsible way to go about it was to try to interview as many people who lived through it themselves and then channel their recollections as objectively as I could and try to corroborate their accounts by interviewing other people. And again, if multiple people are telling the same story about a particular event, then that's a pretty good indication that it's true. And so that was the strategy that I took, not to try to pass judgment on anyone in the story, to give everyone the opportunity to tell their side of the story if they wish to. I wasn't able to bring everyone around. Again, Stephanie and John Rudden both declined or did not respond to my interview request, so I had to approach their parts of the story using other reporting methods. John testified on the witness stand. That's where some of the information that I attribute to him in the book came from. Stephanie had done interviews with reporters like me before she was arrested. That was all fair game to write about her as a person, but that was generally, you know, how I delve into those questions. But yeah, there were definitely some uneasy moments because it has felt all the way through and probably right up until today. It's an embarrassing case for a lot of people in the department. I think there's a fair amount of shame around the circumstances of what happened and how long Stephanie got away with it. And it's not something that people are particularly eager to talk about or that it's very easy to talk about. I remember asking one of the people in the story before the trial, are people talking about the case? They said, no one's talking about it. It's like as if your uncle got arrested for committing, being a serial killer or something. It's like, it's never a good time to like talk about a situation like that around the water cooler. So it sort of keeps getting, it's like under the radar, above the radar a little bit, but it seems clear to me the department's not eager to give the story very much oxygen, but again, that's the department's prerogative, but they're responsible for solving their murder cases. And for me, the reason to do the investigation is, again, you can't have a failure as big as this and not look at what went wrong. And again, my motivation is I have a ton of respect for what homicide detectives do, and there's so many good ones, and even the ones who make missteps or don't do things right, there it's an opportunity to learn and improve, and so that's what motivated how I went about recording the book and writing it the way that I did, as non-judgmentally as possible.
Now, after we lauded you for your journalist integrity, why do you think that initial detective did not follow up on clues given to them? And maybe you could tell them, tell everybody, what you got the case and what did the family think?
Yeah, so
why you didn't pursue that?
Everything that's in the book is based on interviews that I either personally conducted myself or sworn testimony, statements that were given to the LAPD. I know where all the information is from, but according to the Rasmussens and John Rudden, both of them informed detectives within days of the murder that there was a an ex-girlfriend. The Rasmussens did not know the woman's name at the time. John Rudden obviously did know her name, but there's no trace of that. So when I interviewed Lyle Mayer, who was the original lead detective on the case, he was insistent that the Rasmussens never mentioned an ex-girlfriend police officer to him, not even once. He said that John did mention her, but that he minimized the extent of the romantic relationship between them, made it sound as if she was an acquaintance rather than an ex-girlfriend. And he said that if John had been more forthcoming, that he would have pursued Stephanie, and I can't argue with that. I mean, I don't think John was fully forthcoming. So I think there's blame to go around. But the effect of all these close calls is from day one through the day that it's solved, the case is sort of on a knife's edge where it could either fall into oblivion or it could be solved. I mean, evidence goes missing, but not the one piece of evidence that ultimately solves the case. That's the only thing that remains, certain things aren't written down, but then there is one reference to Stephanie that was made in the murder book that, her name must have been mentioned because there was one reference to her in the book back in the 80s. So I tried my best to answer these questions. There's still things that I don't know that bug me. The book's only been out a couple weeks, and I would imagine most people here haven't read it, but if anyone is here, because, for instance, they work with Stephanie or something like that, I'm interested in, I'm continuing to report the story. Hopefully I'll be able to get more answers.
One of the things I found you know, also from the standpoint of writing novels about crime and detective work, this was a fantastic novelistic thing. But it, so it was really interesting to me, but also extremely sad that even after the forensic Frances, after she had identified that this was a woman who bit the victim during the murder, the case stalled out. And there's a deep throat in this case. The murder book mysteriously left downtown police headquarters and ended up on a detective's desk in Van Nuys. And it's a mystery as to how that happened, but that's what re-kicked the case, got it going again. Because it happened to be left on really good detective's desk. And that is so troubling to me, and it's so fascinating at the same time. But you want to talk about that? Like, who was that? Any idea? I mean, one of the things that makes this book so good is the questions that are not answered. And they fire your imagination as a reader. And you think about, like, what if that didn't happen? And that's one of the big ones for me.
Well, what you're referring to and what the title of the book refers to, The Lazarus Files, there was an unmarked cardboard box, an LAPD cardboard box that's used for the Records and Identification Division. So it's used for filing cases away in the archives. But they're real sticklers with following procedure. The box has to be labeled with the division and the date, and it has to have a lid or they won't accept it. But in early 2008, this cardboard box just sort of materialized out of thin air on the desk of this detective, Jim Nuttall, in Van Nuys. Mike, I think when I first shared the book with you, you described it as like an abandoned baby in a basket or something.
Wow.
That's pretty good. That's what I said.
I don't think that
was
exactly that.
But it showed up on this guy's desk, and in the book I describe it as like a Pandora's box that he doesn't even realize that he's opening it until it's already opened. And there were in fact two cases that are in the box, the Rasmussen case, and then a second case that remains unsolved to this day that I write about. I devote one chapter to it at the end of the book, which is the murder of Catherine Braley, a woman who was killed in Van Nuys about 2 years after Sherry's murder. And so Nuttall opens this murder book, pretty quickly comes across the DNA result prepared 4 years earlier by Jennifer Frances. And these guys are pretty humble when they talk about it, Nuttall in particular. He doesn't say that it was a difficult case for him to solve. It was sort of staring at him the moment he saw the female DNA results, just because it's very unusual. There's not many armed female killers running around the San Fernando Valley in the 80s. So his initial thought and that of his squad mates was this wasn't a burglary. We have a woman biting a woman. This is either going to be a love triangle or a lesbian thing or some sort of a personal motive. And the fact that the struggle was so protracted and went on for so long, very physical, also seemed to them much more suggestive of a personal motive than a burglar who you might ordinarily expect would flee, would want to get away, wouldn't want to kill somebody and not steal anything, which is what happened.
Well, I mean, again, I'm just going back to the same thing. So this box is mysteriously left on desk, and the way you described the homicide bureau in Van Nuys is just wonderful about how people had to stand up so people could open files and stuff like that. They're so cramped in there. So this box shows up, and both cases are unsolved, and both either on the face of what's in the box or what would come out soon, had law enforcement officers as suspects. And so the idea that there's somebody in the department who thinks that, you know, I can't go, I don't want to be revealed or I don't want to go public with this, but there might be cops out there killing people and nothing's being done in this office. So I guess in the middle of the night, I'm going to take this box and put it somewhere where hopefully somebody can do something about it. You know, that's a novel to me, and it's staggering that that's a true story.
I have a couple suspects for who I think may have brought the box.
You shouldn't call them suspects.
It's narratives. You're exactly right, because that's exactly right. I'd say I meant in the sense that I suspect that they may have, that they may be the Good Samaritan who did it. But as I say in the book, no one has stepped forward, and it remains a mystery. Detective Nuttall, who is one of the guys who solved the case, told me now that the book is out, he thinks that a lot of people are going to claim to have brought the box, and that none of them will actually be the one who did it. But yeah, again, it's like if you want to believe in divine providence, I mean, there's it's about to sail into oblivion so many times, and then out of nowhere, somebody does something that enables the next thing to happen that leads to justice being done after so many years.
We're going to take questions from the audience, but do you have a final question?
Like you said, there's really no spoilers because we, but I thought, you know, the question initially is, you know, who's really telling the truth? Did the family push hard for the shift, or did the detective was right saying that nobody made much of an effort to tell me who they suspected? But I thought it was a really interesting point in your book when, finally, all these years later, when the detective from Van Nuys calls Nels Rasmussen, the victim's father, and says, "We've solved the case," and what he said immediately. Was very indicative of who's telling the truth.
It was actually before they solved the case. It was Detective Nuttall's initial conversation outreach to Nels Rasmussen, Sherry's father, and he had the DNA results. He knew that it was female. They were just beginning to piece together that it could possibly be Stephanie Lazarus. There was also a nurse who Sherry had worked with, she had had to discipline her, passed over her promotion, and there had been some hard feelings about that. So there were actually two viable female suspects.
What did Nell say? Right.
But when he called and said, "Were there any, you know, what's your feeling, Nels? Who do you think may have done this?" He said, "I know exactly who did this. I don't have her name, but she was a female police officer and an ex-girlfriend of my son-in-law."
That was a really chilling.
And he said, you know, like, if you want to make some money, bet me it's not her or something. Nels had his certainty. Well,
before we go, everyone look forward, because like most really good detectives, they do it for something inside them, and they don't do it to get attention, but we should acknowledge that without, I don't want to point him out or make him feel uncomfortable, but Rob Buff, the guy who supervised this investigation to the arrest, to solving it this year, and I don't think we'd all be here if it wasn't for him and his work.
Yeah, I saw Rob earlier.
Yeah, don't point him out.
You can
hide.
You can just wave.
He's really hiding, so I just want to say thank you to him.
Don't seek out the spotlight. It's something I admire about them. And I think Jennifer Francis is also here, the DNA analyst who was also played a key role.
And deep throats here, but he doesn't want to. So, does anyone here have any questions for, here we go.
What took you 10 years to write the book? I was curious. I may have missed it, but I was wondering what took you so
long. See, it's just all the reporting.
He asked how long it takes 10 years to write the book.
A blizzard of documents, more court transcripts and police reports than I can count. It was a little bit overwhelming, just the amount of documentation. I never anticipated being able to tell the story in the detail that I was eventually able to, but once I was able to, really after the trial happened, because again, the nature of our court system, trials make information public. Anyone can go to the court clerk and get a copy of the exhibits and things like that. Once I had all of the information, that was 3 or 4 years into the process. It was like a blessing and a curse. I could tell the story in incredible detail, but it was very painstaking, sifting through this information, figuring out what I could corroborate, what was important, what was not important. And, you know, there's a lot, the story is 30 years. The book is focuses on really a few years in the 1980s and then a few years, you know, 2009 to 2012. So there's a lot of material that this was left in the cutting room floor as well. And
how many pages was your first draft?
Well over 1,000. But, you know, that included a lot of information, like Stephanie Lazarus kept a diary while she was a patrol officer, and I obtained several years of it. And again, initially, from a drafting perspective, I just was trying to line all the information up chronologically and tell the story as cleanly as I could. Once everything came together, it was clear, I don't think I need this much diary. I'm making my points elsewhere. So a lot of that is what fell away, but.
What did she say on the day of the murder in her diary?
Nothing on the day of the murder because she was off duty, and she only kept her diary when she was on duty, but she actually worked the day after the murder was committed.
She didn't go to a dental appointment?
No, or no dental appointment.
Oh, okay.
Many
tangents. Alibi.
Yeah. Stephanie wrote, she would have these long-winded entries, some of them not very event-filled, kind of banal. But the day after the murder, she wrote, nothing happened today. So little happened that I can't even remember anything happening. Something about playing basketball.
Protesting.
Yeah, so it was like.
Okay, quick question and quick answers.
One of the most compelling parts of this book, I only read half of it, was the stories you tell, the details about relationships. How this unfolded in the first place. You have these three individuals, Sherry, Stephanie, and John. I mean, UCLA grads, and Sherry's this up-and-coming nursing supervisor, and how their lives, their secrets, how everything unfolded. Because you wonder, how in the world could this even...
So how did you get all that?
Yeah, it was a challenge, because if you think about it, it's a love triangle that I'm trying to write about and understand, and one person is dead and the other two people won't talk to me. So,
there's a tremendous struggle to be murdered. Was there no strands of hair or fingerprints or the bite marks kind of point to a woman?
There were no foreign fingerprints that were found. There was quite a bit of blood evidence, but as I said, that all went back to Sherry.
Was she wearing gloves, or does that suggest
that? No, but the fact that she didn't leave any fingerprints suggests that she may have been, yes.
Or did Stephanie?
Go ahead.
I remember, Matt, when you started writing this book, you shared with me, I believe it was on YouTube, the interrogation video, which was extraordinary. Is that still posted on YouTube?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
So what Terry's referring to is that so these Van Nuys guys reopened the case, walked it up to the line, the DNA was a match, and then the case got transferred to Robbery Homicide Division, sort of the elite unit downtown that interrogated Stephanie, and there's a videotape of her that if you just go on to Google Stephanie Lazarus interrogation, you can actually watch the whole thing on YouTube.
Or you can watch 5 season 4 for the river.
I got to invest so much time and effort.
effort. You got to know the victims' parents and people who were involved in this. As a writer, how did this affect you personally? Because I imagine this could really haunt someone.
It's a fascinating story, and any writer you want interest, you're looking for a story. So it wasn't, again, I don't want to make myself sound, what I did was anything other than what I, felt drawn to do. But yeah, to your point, I think the thing that I didn't anticipate was just the number of people who I would meet in the course of looking into this. So many different detectives, the families. As I got to know those people, it made me want to try to do right by them in terms of telling their story fairly, that if they were to pick up the book and read it, that they would recognize themselves in it. That I was fair to everyone, even the people who fell short on their responsibilities. So I feel proud of the product and hopeful that it'll, over time, have a positive impact on the department.
Right, sir.
During your investigation, did you turn up any original evidence that was not found or not evidence?
Did you find evidence that the police never?
No physical evidence. No, nothing. I wasn't out there with the metal detector. Although the murder weapon still has not been found.
Not to get into it, on the other case, the Braley case, he found a lot of stuff that I don't think had ever come to light before. But that's in my book.
We have time for one more question.
Okay, it's got to be really good.
I remember reading about this case 10 years ago in the Times, and a story I remember is Mr. Rasmussen called LAPD and they just put him on hold for 20 minutes. And I was just wondering how certain he was, because I think he suspected Stephanie Lazarus, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I mean, I interviewed him at length, and that's all documented in the book, the different interactions that he recalls having with them.
Real quick, when's the movie?
TBD.
I was just wondering who's going to play Rob
Buck. Rob Buck can play himself in the movie, as far as I know.
Okay, so Matt's going to be up here and he'll sign all your books. Yeah, it's a really great week.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm going to be calling people by their